Hi, this is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Stories of the Supernatural. Wherever you find us, whether it's a video or podcast on your favorite platform, please like and subscribe to us so that you can get notification of when a new show is released. You can also find us on major social media platforms. If you go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com, you can find links to the videos or MP3 files, which you can download and enjoy without commercial interruptions. If you're into classic horror, ghost, and adventure stories, I narrate Nightshade Diary, and you can find links at nightshadediary.com. If scary stories are your bag, and listening to encounters with cryptids, ghosts, dogmen, and other weird creatures sends a shiver up your spine, then go to supernaturalstorytime.com for links to our weekly podcasts. Noteworthy news about the paranormal world, true crime, conspiracy stories, and anything that is just plain weird can be found at eerie.news or visit the Stranger Than Fiction Stories tab at MiamiGhostChronicles.com. Please subscribe to my newsletter on Substack. Just go to mppelliser.com for a link. I want to thank you for being part of my audience, and I think you are all wonderful. Hi, everyone. This is Marlene with Stories of the Supernatural, and this week we're going to revisit the series Mysteries of Old Florida. These are skeleton stories, and it's volume number 4 of the series. The first story starts out in 1875. This is when Henry Keach came to St. Augustine, Florida, and established a farm a few miles away at Matanzas Inlet, named for the massacre of French sailors decades before. Little did he imagine that death stalked him as well. It was June, and Mr. Keach had arrived from Wisconsin in 1873, just only 2 years. He purchased a farm in St. Johns County, 14 miles from the old Fort Matanzas Inlet. He was industrious and prospered. He came with a woman who all believed was his wife. A.J. Smith Newton, calling himself a land prospector, came to the area for several days. A few days passed and Mr. Keach didn't appear. He was known as a prompt man by his neighbors. Mr. Williams, a business associate, came to his house to investigate. Once he arrived at the farm, he found an atrocious murder. Mrs. Keach was shot 3 or 4 times, and the house was ransacked. There was no sign of Henry Keach. Williams raised the alarm with the neighbors, who came and searched the area. His groans led them to the river landing. He was found to have been shot, hit in the head various times, and had his throat slit. He was taken to the city for medical attention. 2 search parties were organized, made up by old hunters called Crackers, which knew every foot of the country perfectly. They traveled shy of 100 miles in search of Mr. Newton, who they suspected was the murderer. Neither whip nor spur was spared, and they found him in Volusia County, near Mellonville, where he was making his way on foot to the St. Johns River. He had abandoned a horse he had taken from Keach. He was described as speaking Spanish like a native, was rather small, with blue eyes and whiskers, had a large scar over his right eye, and used H, or the lack of them, like a cockney. Once under arrest, he said again his name was J. Smith Newton, and he was born in Buenos Aires, Argentina, of English parents. He said his purpose was not robbery, but revenge. He said that the woman known as Mrs. Ellen Keach was not Keach's wife, and that the real Mrs. Keach lived at Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Keach had deserted her and took up with a supposed new Mrs. Keach and fled to Florida. Newton said he was employed by the original Mrs. Keach, who was his aunt, to follow her husband and murder both him and his mistress. As a reward, he was to receive a share of the estate of Mr. Keach, which was worth about $30,000. He was led to confession, since an attempt was made by some of the citizens of Orange County to lynch him. Initially, it was believed the motive for the crime was robbery, but Newton carried on his person a letter waiting to be mailed, where he told his aunt, Mary Ann, that he had done what she instructed and killed both Henry Keach and the woman he was living with. It seemed he had posed as an investor with Keach and persuaded him to go out in his boat fishing. When he got near the shore of a small creek, he got behind and shot him in the head and neck. The ball in the neck
struck Keach near the head and ranged down, not going very deep, but the other one was over the right eye and glanced off, but stunning him only. Newton then took him out of the boat and threw him into the marsh, and to make sure the job was done right, he pounded Keach's head into pumice stone, then he cut his throat from ear to ear. The police laid a trap for Mrs. Keach and sent her the letter her nephew had written her. Marianne Keach, upon hearing what she thought was her husband's death, went to Florida and was arrested, and worst of all, found out that her husband was still alive. The perpetrator's real name was William Newton. In October 1875, Marianne Keach, née Green, was convicted for her part of the murder of Ellen Hunt, also known as Ellen Keach, as accessory before the fact. During the trial, it described where Henry Keach married a woman known as Marianne Newton about 1850. After 20 years, they quarreled and divorced. He left to Florida promising to record certain property that was supposed to come to her as part of the divorce proceedings before leaving Wisconsin. He never did pass the properties to her. It took Marianne Keach 3 years to find the whereabouts of her husband in Florida. She hired her nephew William Newton to kill them and obtain the title deeds which the court had decreed her. There was no sentimental motive behind your actions, strictly a monetary one. The newspapers described Marianne Keach as, quote, "The murderess is a burly woman, with a countenance that does not belie her nature. She received her sentence with the most stolid indifference, gazing at the judge with a defiant look, and seemingly anxious to get upon the platform and wring his neck," end quote. William Newton and his aunt were found guilty and sentenced to hang. But in April 1876, the Supreme Court reversed the sentence of death for both of them, and they were to be tried with a change of venue. It's unknown what sentence, if any, was handed down for Marianne Keach, but she returned to Wisconsin and married 3 more times. She outlived all her husbands except the last one. She died in 1918, age 72. Henry survived the brutal attack. However, he never left Florida and died in 1903, age 75. William Newton was spared the hangman's noose, but was instead sent to serve a life sentence. In March 1879, convicts employed by Mr. Chairs near Live Oaks in Leon County made an attempt to escape. One was killed and another wounded, but Newton and another man escaped. In May 1880, a skeleton was found in a marshy area which was believed to belong to Newton. It's believed he was ignorant of the localities, and after he escaped from prison, he wandered through the woods and swamps until exhausted. So it seems that justice was served after all. The second story starts out in 1886, Palatka, Florida, October 30th, the day before Halloween. What was left was just a skeleton and was found in a pine stand at a place called the Devil's Elbow. A boy hunting found him. His head lay to the roots of the pine tree, and his flesh had been completely stripped off by animals and buzzards. The condition of the clothes indicated he had been dead several months and that he might have been the victim of the prior winter's freeze. The clothes consisted of an overcoat and a neat suit. The pants were stuck into the tops of the boots. The linen shirt had 2 gold studs in the bosom. They were inlaid with pearl, and in one of the pockets was found a Waterbury watch. There was also a fine knife, an ivory-handled watch key, and a pencil inside the pockets, but no papers or money were found. In one corner of a silk handkerchief was the name D. Stedman, plainly written with indelible ink, but there was nothing else to identify the body. The upper teeth of the man were false and set in a rubber plate. The overcoat was stained red in places, but it was unknown if it was red paint or blood. It was judged the man was Caucasian, measured about 6 feet in height, and he was neatly dressed. From scraps of hair that were still attached to the skull, it seemed he was probably 40 or 50 years of age, since the remnants were sprinkled with gray. Strangely, Judge Houghton declined to hold an inquest over the remains and ordered the bones buried. However, a day after the discovery, the young man who found the skeleton and who worked in the orange grove belonging to Martin Griffin, described were several months before four or five men who he described as hard cases and which were intoxicated were walking in the area where the bones were found. A few days later, he noticed buzzards congregated there in large numbers, but he thought it was a carcass of a dead animal that they were eating, so he didn't pay any attention. Now he believed this man was killed by his companions. This story put into doubt the theory the stranger had died due to the freeze. 2 days later, E.T. Gale, the coroner, claimed there was a strong suspicion the stranger was murdered, since it seemed the skull was split at the back as if by a sharp instrument of some kind. This reinforced the theory the man had been the victim of foul play. A tramp that worked in the area where the bones were found spoke of stealing a hatchet from a house. It was decided to search the grounds in case they could find the hatchet, which might turn out to be the murder weapon, but nothing was ever found. The months went by, and on December 11, 1886, a letter was received from New Haven, Connecticut. It read the following. A friend of mine tells me that a month ago, he saw in your paper an account of the finding of a body of a man at the back of Devil's Elbow. Will you kindly send me a copy of the paper containing the item? E. M. Andrews went from here early last year and set up a sawmill at the land. He went from there to Jacksonville January 1, 1886, and has not since been heard from. Yours truly, F. B. Farnsworth. It turned out that September 1886, there was an ongoing search for a certain E. M. Andrews, who disappeared into the wilds of Central Florida since the first days of 1886. It took a year for a connection to be made between his disappearance and the bones found at the Devil's Elbow. E. M. Andrews had left for DeLand, Florida in January with thousands of dollars worth of sawmill machinery to start a new business. However, 9 months later, he had disappeared. A member of the Masonic Lodge in Connecticut asked Mr. Perkins with a lodge in DeLand to help in locating him. Behind the scenes, the two mysteries were joined, and the story of Mr. Andrews and the man's skeleton disappeared from the newspapers. That is, until February 1889, over 2 years after the discovery, when a small article was mentioned in a Connecticut newspaper, referring where E. M. Andrews, who was murdered in Florida in January 1886, was declared dead and the Masonic Lodge he belonged to paid benefits to his widow. And that would have been the end of that, except in September 1889, Mr. Andrews, who had been a wealthy architect and builder, was found very much alive living in Oregon. The Masonic fraternity who had paid his widow insurance benefits were asking for a refund, and until this arrangement was finalized is when he would step out of his hiding place. Andrews refused to meet with newspaper reporters, and he had H.C. Baldwin from Naugatuck act as his spokesman. It turned out that he had been living in Portland, Oregon, where for a time he spent years as a young man. What he had done since January 1st of 1886 until then remained a mystery. There were some dark hints of a southern romance. Others talked of a mental aberration from which he had just recovered. Andrew's life, until this strange action, had been anything but unusual. He served in the Union Army during the Civil War and was wounded in the arm. He graduated from Yale Scientific School as a civil engineer in 1876. This was the same year he married Julia Maria Hill. They moved to Naugatuck in 1881 when he received the commission for the erection of the town hall. He went on to design other buildings, and along the way he made a host of friends, most of them among men of influence in the town. Evelyn Marcellon Andrews, that's his name, was described as a man of more than medium height with sandy beard and dark eyes. He was considered a shrewd businessman, and he was an, quote, interesting talker on familiar subjects, end quote. He got investors in Connecticut to back him on a venture in Florida for the sawmill. He went in a schooner fitted out expensively at New Haven and landed at Palatka, Florida. He went up the St. John's River to DeLand and then 4 miles further into the swamps and forest of Highland Park, we established the second largest sawmill in the state. This was on the land of Major Norris, who also advanced him money to get the enterprise started. Perhaps he saw the potential when 5 new railroad lines were attracted to Palatka during the 1880s, and tourists, lumber, and the citrus industries were growing. However, in 1884, a great fire wiped out the entire business district, and instead of rebuilding with wood, the structures were made from brick. He obtained a large railroad contract, but after that he failed disastrously, lumber going to $8 and $10. He persisted with the business, however, he was a slave driver with those working for him, and threats were made against his life. His wife went to Florida and stayed with him, but she eventually returned to Connecticut. In the summer of 1885, he contracted malaria and was said at times to show symptoms of insanity. He got behind in business and became very discouraged. He tried to raise more money, but then he disappeared mysteriously. His brother-in-law came to Florida to find him, and a reward of $500 was offered for any news of him, dead or alive, and an announcement with his description was distributed throughout the state. He was last seen alive in Deland on December 28, 1885, and January 1, 1886, he was seen in Whiteman and Christopher's store on Bay Street, Jacksonville. His partners attempted to carry on the business without him, but the following year the whole place burned down and they had no insurance. The evidence that Andrews had been murdered by some of his help was thought to be conclusive by the Masonic fraternity to which he belonged. When the skeleton was found at Devil's Elbow, it seemed they had found the answer as to what happened to E.M. Andrews. It was supposed that now that he had been found alive, many lawsuits were apt to follow. Perhaps this was why he was slow to return from the West Coast. In October 1889, his wife received a letter from him written in California. He did not return to Naugatuck until December 1889, but he was not destitute and had $20,000. He never explained how he had come by the money. When he returned to Connecticut, it seemed all was not well with Mrs. Andrews, who for 3 years believed herself to be a widow. He arrived at their home only to find it empty since she moved with her father in Moosup. He went to live with his sister in New Britain, where he would remain. In 1898, he made ready to set out to the Klondike with a machine that melted ice-bound ground in winter. This was a process used in digging for gold. What became of the venture is unknown. However, he continued to do business in Connecticut, and in July 1891, he bought land with plans to divide it into building lots. His wife Julia died in 1918 and was interred at the Hill family plot. Evelyn Marcellon Andrews, better known as E.M. Andrews, died in 1934 at the age of 90. He was buried at New Rock Landing Cemetery in Haddam, Connecticut. There is one mystery that remained unsolved. Who was the unfortunate fellow who met a grisly end at the Devil's Elbow? Next story, Skeleton at the Scrub. On Halloween 1900, Sanitary Chief George Walker made a startling discovery while conducting a house-to-house inspection. He came upon the skeleton of a woman. It was in the rear of a vacant house at 817 Constance Street, Tampa. This neighborhood was known as the Scrub. The bones were not white and polished such as the ones used by physicians or medical students. They were dark and a little charred, as if the flesh had been recently burned from them. Wisp of wavy, fine reddish-brown hair still clung to the skull. It appeared a skeleton had been buried in the trash pile and disturbed by prowlers. The house was built on the plan of a store and had been unoccupied for several months. The last steady occupants had been Dr. Daniel W. Culp and an undertaker with the last name of Green. Dr. Culp had suddenly left Tampa in June 1899 after the mysterious death of M.J. Christopher, and he could not be located in order to shed some light on the mystery. It was believed that Dr. Culp's intimacy with Christopher would lead to evil results to himself, which accounted as to why he had departed mysteriously and quickly out of Tampa. After the Undertaker, there was a grocery store, and then another unnamed business. The premises adjoined one of Tampa's most notorious brothels known as Madame Hilda Raymond. A report of the discovery was made to Chief Robert of the police department and to Sheriff T.K. Spencer. Visitors came to the courthouse to view the remains, but none could identify who the bones belonged to. An examination of the skeleton confirmed the theory of foul play, since it seemed the flesh had been eaten from the bones by the use of some acid. There was also a rancid odor, suggesting that death had not been that long before. It was judged she could not have been dead any more than 3 or 4 months. Dave Bradley, who lived in the area, was the only one who could offer information on the subject. He said that Green, the Undertaker, had once spoken to him about a skeleton which Dr. Culp possessed, and which the doctor had left on the premises when he moved from the city. There were two theories held by the police. Sheriff Spencer believed the skeleton was left behind by Dr. Culp and was thrown into the yard when he left. Deputy Sheriff Jack Stevens thought the hair clinging to the skull had been pasted on as a questionable decoration and wasn't the person's original hair. Neither one of them believed that the skeleton was proof of foul play. However, Chief of Police Roberts believed the skeleton was that of a murder victim. He said the hair and smell of recent decomposition meant it was not left behind by Dr. Culp, and also the fact that it was stained and not polished like anatomical bones. There was no clothing found at the scene to lend a clue. Also, there was no fracture or other evidence of injury on the skeleton. There have been no mysterious disappearances of women in the city in recent times. At least none reported. Chief Walker said the trash heap had been removed and another one substituted during the 7 days prior to the discovery. He said that the alley had been thoroughly cleared of rubbish on the Monday previous. It was believed that the skeleton had been burned, but no one could verify where it was burned. Now there was a question if the rubbish heap had originated at another place and had been brought there. Despite there being evidence that the woman had not died from natural causes, and her remains were burned by acid to probably disguise her identity, the investigation never went beyond the initial discovery of her bones. It also appeared to be pointedly overlooked that she was found right next to a brothel. In 1903, a 20-year-old prostitute named Mamie Foster killed herself by drinking 3 ounces of carbolic acid. When her family refused to pay for her funeral, Hilda Raymond, the madam, footed the bill. Perhaps the skeleton was a woman who had died, not by her own hand, but by another. It could have been murder, or even the result of a botched abortion. Either way, Hilda might have been a soft touch with her girls, but the last thing she needed was the law in her establishment poking around about a dead prostitute. Hilda Raymond, one of the most infamous madams in Tampa, outlived all of those involved in the short-lived investigation of the skeleton in the scrub. By 1914, she identified herself as Mrs. G. D. Bryan and had moved to Baltimore. What became of the bones, no one knows, much less who it was and what happened to her. Next story happened, well, it came to a conclusion after the turn of the century. A man was found 9 years after he disappeared. It made the papers in Daytona. However, the one question never asked is, what happened to him? James S. Todd was 23 years old when he was discharged from the Union Army for a disability in 1863. He had served in the 1st Regiment, Ohio Infantry, Company E, as a hospital steward. In the late 1870s, he came to Florida in the company of a Mr. Kleppinger and settled in the area that would eventually become Daytona. He occupied a log cabin in the Block 20 of what 20 years later would be Ridgewood Avenue. He stayed for about 18 months, returned to Ohio, but came back in 1886. He was known as well-educated and from a good family, his uncle being the war governor of Ohio. His one weakness was a love of strong drink. Some would say this was his undoing, when he went on a bender for a few days in 1892. He left Daytona and went south, last being seen at Fowler's Point. A few days after, he disappeared. Search parties went out for him and tracked him to the shore of Strickland Bay near Spruce Creek. But from there, no further clue was found of where he headed to. On February 26, 1901, Mr. Baker, who lived on Turnbull Bay in Spruce Creek, was out hunting hog and came across a human skeleton on a low island in the marshes. Charles R. Cox and Oscar Michael went down in a boat after he reported what he found. Baker acted as their guide. There was strong evidence, even after 9 years, to confirm the identity of the remains. First, his gold-filled teeth, his open-faced watch, the truss he was known to wear, a big graphite pencil he used, and his nose glasses with a tortoiseshell frame. His watch was found under the bones. The underjaw was several feet away, and some of the limbs were scattered, possibly rooted around by hogs. He carried a bunch of keys and a ring. The iron ones had been mostly consumed except for a brass one. His sister Sally Hook had the remains shipped to Ohio, where he was interred with the rest of his family. What became of his partner Kleppinger is unknown. Strangely, there was no questioning as to what happened to Todd. There was no mention if he committed suicide, was murdered, or simply got lost. Was it a lack of curiosity? Or what's that saying about letting sleeping dogs lie?
The next story takes place in the year 1915. As a matter of fact, February 1st, 1915, places the Ponce Park in Daytona. And this was a very placid, calm park where white cottages were found under the live oaks. And it was known for being the haven of women with children and anglers who came to fish. However, it was stirred up when 7 skeletons were discovered by Postmaster Frank Stone when he dug up his back lot. Stone had been grubbing some palmetto, live oak, and bay bushes near the east side of his property and along the road leading south to the Ponce de Leon Inlet Lighthouse. He broke the skull with his hoe, and once he realized it was a cranium, he began a careful excavation. The entire skeleton was unearthed, and he kept digging and finally exhumed 7 skeletons. Captain B.J. Pichetti thought they may have been the crew of a wrecked sailing vessel who were then massacred by Indians when they landed on shore. Others believed they were the unfortunate members of Dr. Turnbull's colony. There was good reason to believe this, as it turned out back in 1764, the British Parliament set aside 500 British pounds sterling as a bounty for cultivating silk, cotton, and indigo in East Florida, and authorized generous land grants for citizens who volunteered to travel and develop these industries. Dr. Andrew Turnbull, a Scottish physician, convinced several of his wealthy British friends to start the new colony. His plans were to employ Greeks from Asia Minor as laborers, since they were accustomed to a warmer climate. At this time, conditions were difficult for the Greeks due to living under the rule of the Ottoman Empire. He was knowledgeable in this area since he had spent several years as a consul in the Ottoman Empire and married a Greek woman named Maria Gracia Durabin, a Smyrna in Greece. 20,000 acres were granted for the colony, and Turnbull traveled south from St. Augustine until he came to Mosquito Inlet, where he found an attractive tract of land dotted with magnolia, live oak, and bay trees. He named the site New Smyrna. The Ottomans resisted his attempt to hire the Greeks, and he returned with about 1,500 workers, most of them Minorcans, from Minorca, which is one of the Balearic Islands located in the Mediterranean Sea belonging to Spain. These were indentured servants who, once they finished their indenture, would be given a plot of land in East Florida or be given passage to return home. By the end of the summer in 1768, New Smyrna was settled. The work was difficult, and a number of workers died from disease or met violent deaths at the hands of the Indians. Turnbull's relationship with laborers deteriorated as the years went by, due on account that not only of the poor working conditions, but the harsh practices of the overseers hired by Turnbull. In 1777, the laborers marched northward to St. Augustine to complain to Governor Patrick Tonin, who provided them with shelter. Were these their remains? A third version of their identity was that they were killed during the Civil War as a number of skirmishes took place in the vicinity of the inlet. When the road was graded through from river to the ocean 15 years before, a 24-pound cannonball was dug up in the grading which had been dropped by a Union gunboat. Charles W. Jones, one of the oldest citizens in the town, cleared a tract of land where he lived and found a human skeleton. Along with it was a flintlock pistol, a small daguerreotype picture frame, and some brass buttons. Some believe these bones were older than the ones Jones found. However, there were no clues around them to help in identifying them. They belonged to mature men of average build. The only thing found was a half-buried coral rock that weighed about 10 pounds. Perhaps this had been a marker. The skeletons were under twin live oaks. The rock was about 3 feet south of the tree further south and within 1 foot of the nearest skull. Whether by design or not, the twin oaks stood a step apart north and south, and another step would bring you to the coral rock, and a foot further was the nearest body. There was evidence of foul play, and the bodies were piled on each other, as many of the bones of the arms and legs lay crisscrossed, and the skulls of several were in such proximity to indicate a hasty burial or indifference when disposing of the dead. Some of the skulls were whole, even to the lower jaw, with many of the teeth, and others were cracked and eroded. The remains were only a few inches below the surface, and the roots of a nearby tree and bushes had grown into the skulls through the openings of the eye sockets and nostrils. Captain Pacetti was sure his father, Captain Bartoli Pacetti, had never mentioned any massacre, and he had come to the area in 1843. There was a massacre by the Indians south of the inlet shortly after he arrived, but the victims were shipwrecked. Once the Indians left towards the west, Captain Pacetti and the others buried the victims of the massacre. There was a shell mound on the land now owned by Theodore Rhodes, which was surrounded by beautiful citrus groves and bore evidence of having been used as an ancient fort. It bore a commanding view and range of the Halifax River. Grandma Sheldon, who died of old age at New Smyrna a few years before, could not have imagined that where she played as a girl under the centuries-old live oaks, which grew on an old shell mound at her doorstep, and several feet beneath the shells were buried concrete steps and masonry, the work of a people who lived there long ago. Ultimately, it was decided that these were the remains of those massacred by the Indians, and any possibility of knowing who they were had long since disintegrated. They were reburied in an anonymous grave in a potter's field. Now, this next case is a little bit further south into Florida, down Miami. It's all about bones. Bones that are found on the bank of the Miami Canal on April 12, 1917. The police immediately compared the crime to the murder of Eddie Kinsey, whose body had been discovered in similar circumstances a few months before. What was left of the man was only a skeleton, with evidence that he was a victim of foul play. The bones were taken to undertaker W. H. Combs. From the general appearance, the remains had been left on this lonely spot for about 6 months. It had been scattered by buzzards, which had cleaned away the flesh, and only traces of garments were left behind. There was also a pair of tan shoes, hardly used, which later were proven to have been purchased at an Avenue D shop. A burnt buckle showed that he wore a leather belt around his waist. The examination of the remains indicated the man was struck in the head, and there was a hole on the left side of the skull. He was probably killed someplace else and then taken to the lonely spot and left on a small hammock about 100 feet from the canal bank. Mulch was spread on top of him, and then it was burned. It seemed the perpetrators were in a hurry to dispose of their victim and place the body on the opposite side of the canal. It would probably have been years before the remains would have been discovered if it wasn't that a work gang run by Frank Hardy came across it. They were building the roadway along the north bank of the canal. The men burned off the little piece of hammock in order to extend the road through when the men ran across the bones. The coroner's jury rendered a verdict that he came to his death by a blow on the head from a sharp instrument by parties unknown. Two cameo cuff buttons were among the clues being used to establish his identity. Deputy Sheriff Frank McDade and his staff believe the murdered man was none other than Olson Dutch Allison, a fisherman who who had been missing since October when he was wanted as a witness in a blind tiger case, which was another word for a speakeasy. He had been a resident of the city for several years and was employed by the Cassell Fish Company. He was last seen by M.L. Lewis, and at that time he was dressed in a good suit of clothes and spoke as of intentions to leave the city on a boat that he was to have joined in Key West. Allison was locked up with another man and was released under $100 bail as a material witness, but never responded when the case was called and the bond was declared forfeited. Since then, Allison had not been seen in the city. Soon after the discovery, friends of Allison expressed a belief that the body discovered in April was him. However, after 72 hours of the discovery of the body, the supposed dead man was found to be very much alive. According to D.S. Jones, Allison was at Mobile, Alabama, and had written to him asking for money. The sheriff had heard of other rumors but had no definite source for them. However, no one ever actually saw Allison alive again. Rumors and hearsay from friends that he was alive were not definitive proof. In the meantime, the unidentified body found at the canal was displayed at Combs Morgue, and no one could venture any clue to the identity of the victim. The coroner and the doctor placed the bones in their natural position and estimated he was about 5 feet 6 inches tall, and based on his teeth, they estimated his age to be 30 to 40. The identity of the body would remain unknown, and it perhaps was Allison after all, and he was destined to be buried in an unnamed grave. The 6 months it was estimated the body had lain there coincided with the discovery of Eddie Kinsey's body on the bank of the same canal on October 14, 1916. It could be estimated they were killed within days of each other. Kinsey was horribly beaten, thrown overboard, and was in the act of crawling out on the canal bank when he was shot multiple times. It could be no coincidence that both of them were to be witnesses against the illegal liquor business being run out of Miami's Tenderloin area known as Hardyville. On April 21, 1917, there was a development around the mysterious murders when a raid was made on a downtown Blind Tiger operation. Dade became a dry county on January 1914, 6 years before Prohibition became the law of the land across the United States. All the liquor licenses issued before this date became invalid. It seemed this was the catalyst for all the skullduggery occurring in Hardyville. It turned out that an attempt was made on another sheriff's witness who knew about the speakeasies. The witness had given information about illicit sale of liquor on Avenue D near 13th Street. This address might have been close or the actual site of what would become Miami's oldest dive bar known as Tobacco Road. According to the county properties appraiser, there wasn't a building at 1812 Avenue D until 1916. During its 100-plus history, it would be a speakeasy, posing as a bakery, gambling den, gay bar, strip joint, and blues bar. It closed in 2014, and the building was demolished. This latest witness was struck on the head and carried to the foot of 2nd Street and the Bay, where he was placed unconscious in a boat. A sudden appearance of a stranger saved his life. The man was found with his head hanging over the edge of the boat while his assailants fled in a carriage. He was taken to a doctor, where when he regained consciousness, said he could identify who attacked him. The discovery of the man's body in April heightened the pressure on the police. It all centered on Hardyville, a thriving red light district which emerged in the northwest sector of Miami, and the murder of Eddie Kinsey. Jasper Kinsey identified the body of his son Eddie from photographs. It turned out an officer Starling was using him to get information of which bootleggers to arrest. Willie Kinsey, Eddie's brother, testified that he was in Miami the night of the murder and stayed at the Green Tree Inn. Eddie told him he was going to the Hardyville section to keep an appointment and that he would return soon and spend the night at the hotel. Willie never saw his 20-year-old brother alive again. He was discovered by a fisherman lying on the south bank of the Miami Canal with his legs in the water and one hand stretched over the bank. His shirt was torn from his body, indicating he might have fought for his life. His dark trousers were also torn and spattered with blood from his wounds. Inside a pocket, they found a letter from his mother warning against bad company and drink. He had no money.
Near the body were prints of automobile wheels. Dr. Jardin, who examined the body, said he had never seen a man who had been so brutally beaten. He said it was done with a heavy instrument, possibly a monkey wrench, and that his head was almost beaten to a pulp. It was believed he was insensate when thrown in the water, which revived him, and when he tried to climb out of the canal, he was shot. One bullet struck him in the back of the head and came out his throat. Another struck him under the left shoulder and ranged down through his stomach, and the other struck him in the arms. He was shot by a high-powered gun, and a bullet from a .38 caliber revolver was found at the scene. At the inquest, when it came to motive, it was ascertained that Kinsey was much disliked by a number of people who frequented Hardeeville on account of his assistance to police in raiding blind tigers. Many of the chauffeurs who worked the Hardeeville area opined that Kinsey was in Dutch with many of the prostitutes. Kinsey had formerly operated a hacking car between Fort Lauderdale and Miami. His father had taken away his car and given it to another brother because of his heavy involvement with Frida Manuel, a prostitute. Initially, four people were arrested in connection to the crime as witnesses. They were Marion Ogle, Jack Arnold, Joe Schatt, and Frida Manuel. It wasn't until April, 6 months after Eddie Kinsey's murder, that William Shields, who by now had lost his job as a policeman, was charged with the murder. The crime was sworn out by Joe Schacht, an automobile driver who was twice arrested in connection with the murder himself as a witness, but who was released on each occasion. He accused Lieutenant William Shields and Max Starling as participating in the murder of Kinsey. Previous to this, Starling had been arrested for selling liquor. The case reached epic proportions when 2 weeks later the discovery of the unidentified man was found at the canal and the connection was made between the two crimes. Shields hired Judge George A. Worley as his counsel. A spiritualist medium was summoned as a witness, and rumors were that a trumpet meeting might be rehearsed at the trial. More than 70 witnesses were summoned for the hearing. Needless to say, it was a packed courtroom every day of the trial. On April 25, 1917, Shields provided an alibi for his whereabouts when Eddie Kinsey was murdered. The prosecution wanted to prove his alibi was for another night and not the night when Kinsey was killed. The first witness was policeman F.M. McDade, who arrested Dick Welch the night before the murder. He stated Welch had showed fight during the arrest and he was obliged to hit him on the head with the butt end of his pistol. He put Welch in the police car and was on the way to the station when he stopped at the Dixie Highway garage to get gasoline. They dressed Welch's wound at Sawyer's drugstore, but he was bloody and had to be held in the car by Officer Hart and another man who was in the back seat. Officer Hart was called to testify and he upheld the story told by McDade. The testimony of these two men exploded the murder car theory, which was that Kinsey's body was taken from Hardeeville in an automobile that stopped at the Dixie Highway garage for gasoline en route to the canal where his body was dumped. Shields testified that he had heard rumors they were going to try to get him and that he had been warned not to go to Hardeeville that night because there were plans to kill him. He said that Frida Manuel, a habitué, which was a euphemism for prostitute, had warned him. He denied accepting graft while on the force. H.B. Doan, the night desk sergeant, testified that Shields was asleep in the police station from 2 until 6 a.m. in the morning of the murder. George Attem, a proprietor of a Greek restaurant in which Kinsey was seen shortly before the murder, was the last witness called to testify. He denied he had seen Kinsey that night. However, he was possessed of poor memory, and all he remembered was going to bed that night about 1:30 a.m. Kinsey's coat was left in the restaurant, and that Mike, one of his employees, told him he gave Kinsey the coat back. A witness for the prosecution was Mrs. A.J. Higgins, a spiritualist medium who failed to state anything which would show complicity on the part of Shields in the murder of Eddie Kinsey. It was noted by the newspapers that for a medium she possessed an unusually poor memory, and what facts she did remember were dragged from her by persistent questioning. She testified that Shields had come to her twice for a sitting. Once he was accompanied by Frank McDade. When asked if she knew Frida Manuel, real name Frida Manuel, who worked in Hardeeville, she said no. Shields later testified that he met Kinsey 8 months before. He was approached by Kinsey while on patrol in Hardeeville with a report of a policeman drunk in one of the resorts, and Shields was sent to investigate. He took a pair of handcuffs off of Kinsey, who said they belonged to a man in Fort Lauderdale. Shields said he had seen Kinsey several times riding around with a hackman or buying whiskey until his funds were gone. Then he would return to Lauderdale and get more money from his family. He spent part of his time in Lauderdale and another part in Hardeeville. On the night of the murder, according to the testimony, Shields got in a hack driven by C.F. Dad Miller and rode to Hardeeville. It stopped in front of Carrie Ryan's brothel. There, Shields met patrolman M.C. Hart. From there, they got into an automobile and sat there talking for about 40 minutes. Officer Hart substantiated this version. Shields admitted seeing Kinsey as he passed the Greek restaurant on the way to a drugstore at 5th Street and Avenue D. He had responded to the drugstore because there had been a stabbing on the premises. From there, Shields returned to the police station where he stayed from 2 to 6 a.m. Eventually, it came to light that Kinsey had been seen in Beckwith Hewitt's auto when it stopped at the Dixie Highway garage. According to Walter McGee, an employee of the garage, the other men in the car were Red Ryan and others who, quote, were accompanying a man who was bleeding from the mouth, nose, and ears and was struggling with his necktie, which was drawn tightly around his neck, end quote. McGee, when asked about the injured man, was told that Beckwith's brother had beaten him and they were taking him to a physician. Beckwith confirmed the man in the car had gotten into a fight with his brother. Supposedly, the injured man was Mose Howard. Another witness was Frida Emanuel, the Hardeeville prostitute, who was said to have been infatuated with Kinsey and to know considerable about the crime. The cause of Kinsey's murder was believed to be his activity in connection with raids on Blind Tigers. On April 26, 1917, Shields was discharged, and many believed that the murder of Kinsey would never be found. The governor instructed the Kinsey case should be further investigated, as most of it reflected on the illegal liquor trade and vice occurring in Hardeeville. By June 1917, two prostitutes, Pauline Ballard and Anna Bryce, along with Joe Shack and Beckwith Hewitt, were all indicted in connection to the murder of Eddie Kinsey. A month later, there was still no progress in producing the actual murderers of Eddie. There was so much pressure related to the case that Chief of Police W.J. Whitman was considering an early retirement because of it. By January of 1918, two new indictments were issued in the Kinsey case. One was for Joseph L. Arnold, formerly a chauffeur who at the time of the indictment was a sergeant in the aviation service of the United States Army at a camp near Augusta, Georgia, and Jack Adam, a Syrian fruit dealer. Both were charged with murder in the first degree. Jack Allen formerly conducted a soft drink place in Hardeeville and was driving a jitney when he was arrested. There was once a rumor that Kinsey had been kidnapped and killed by a group of Syrians who were hired to do away with him. However, this was one of many rumors that surrounded this murder. In February 1918, Joe Shack was acquitted, mostly due to the disappearance of a minister by the name of Anderson, who was to appear as a witness. Beckwith Hewitt had his indictment nulled. There were rumors that both of them had asked to be inducted into the armed services at once. Hewitt did go on to serve, and it's unknown if Shack did so. The death of Eddie Kinsey remained unsolved. Also, who killed Olson Dutch Allison, if that was indeed his body, and who tried to kill the third of the police witnesses. Hardeeville was a dangerous place, and there were plenty who killed to make sure business stayed the same as usual. Was it the cops who were using these men as informants, but were they really informing on their competition? Was it the owners of these illicit speakeasies who took care of snitches? 100 years later, all who could shed light on these answers took them to the grave.